in this comment section, I could click on the Facebook profiles of the people. So I would click on the profiles, and I could see that many of them that were commenting these really horrible comments, they were they seemed quite normal. They could have a steady job, they seemed to have a family, they would post with their friends or children in their profile picture. In many ways, they seemed like really normal.
That's Shida Lian, and this is the latest episode of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is a show all about risk and uncertainty in all aspects of life. The All Things Risk podcast speaks to some amazing risk takers. We talk about some of the biggest risks of our time and loads of other stuff in between. To kick off this episode, I wanted to ask you all a question, and that was, have you ever caught yourself scrolling through the comments section of an article or a Twitter thread and wondered, where in the world do these trolls come from? What are the origins of all of this hateful and toxic speech? Well, my guest this week wondered the same thing, so much so that he made a documentary and a book about it. I want you to meet Shida Lian, a 27-year-old Norwegian journalist and documentarist. Last year, he was named by Forbes as one of the 30 young media entrepreneurs defining the ever-shifting world of news and content. Shida spent 3 years researching and traveling the world to meet and spend time with so-called internet warriors, which became the title of his documentary and book, Internet Warriors, or Internet Commentators, or perhaps less charitably, Internet Trolls, were the subject of this project, which took him from his native Norway to the UK, to Middle America, the Ukraine, Russia, and Lebanon. And he met these people who, frankly, let him into their homes and their lives. And the film certainly captures the hateful views of these people, but I also think it captures the inherent inconsistencies and contradictions of those views, along with the loneliness and even the humanity of many of its subjects. Now, you might think that a project like this gives these people even more of a platform to voice hateful and perhaps false information. And in a sense, that might be true, but it's also a project that is not about celebrating any of these people. In fact, when I watched the film, the sentiment I had was, in fact, one of pity. Shida talks about all of that, going from the origins of the project to how he put it together and also its broader implications. We also talk about his approach to risk-taking as a journalist. He's been in the Donbass region of eastern Ukraine to cover the Ukraine-Russia conflict and has a number of other projects planned. Two words of warning, however. First, Shida reads some of his subject's comments, which are filled with extreme and at times hateful language, so if you are in a public place, make sure you've got your earbuds in. Or if you're driving the kids to school, maybe you want to save this one for later. The second warning was that for whatever reason, Shida's voice in this recording is a bit higher than it normally sounds. So if you know Shida or have heard him speak before, you'll know that his voice is deeper than what it sounds here. Not quite sure what happened there. Nonetheless, it's a great episode with loads of wonderful insights. So we decided to look past that. So folks, let's get into it. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Shida Lian. Welcome to the All Things Risk podcast. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
So we'll get into some very interesting aspects of your documentary and the work that you did, The Internet Warriors, which is so well done and so well filmed. and just a fascinating look at this world of internet commentators. But before we do, I wanted to get into a little bit of your background and how you got into documentary making and where, you know, how you got to what you're doing today.
So I've been doing this for about 9 years. I'm 27 now, and I started when I was about 16. Mm-hmm. So I was bicycling around in Oslo, Norway, where I'm residing, and I was photographing crime incidents. So I had a police scanner and was photographing like stabbings and armed robberies and things like that, and sold it to the newspapers. And that's where I began. And now I'm working as a photojournalist and doing videos, doing documentaries. I'm doing quite a lot of different things. I always like to say that, like, I'm working in with war photography, with wedding photography, and these internet commenters or internet trolls. So it's quite a diverse background, I think.
That's really interesting. When you think about crime in Oslo, I don't equate the two. You know, when I think about Oslo as a peaceful city and so on. But what caused you to get intrigued by this filming crimes? What was it that is there anything that you can kind of pinpoint that kind of led you to that?
I think so all of my family, they are musicians, and I grew up as a musician as well. I was playing the cello, and I did that quite intensively for a number of years, from I was like 8 years old. And I think maybe that was like, I wanted a contrast in my life. I wanted to do something that was completely different. That was something not sitting inside a room and practicing my cello. And I'm really not sure exactly how it began, but I think I've always been really interested in things that maybe aren't that visible in the normal society that we are seeing, things that are visually interesting. And I think that was also what drew me into bicycling around and photographing crime at age of 16.
How did you get a nose for where to find the crime before the police did?
I always had a police scanner. So mm-hmm. I have these quite vivid memories of me at school and having the police scanner. Sometimes I had it on my headset without, you know, trying to get without the teachers knowing about it. But I was always like, I always had it with me, and I could quite notice when things were heating up. You can hear the voices of the policemen, of the policewomen scrambling to do something to a scene or incident. And then I knew that, okay, this might be something interesting. So then I ran outside, usually, sometimes skipping class in order to get there as soon as possible.
And the goal was to get there before the police did or around the same time?
Yeah, and at least like getting there in order to photograph something that was quite intriguing and when the news story was developing.
Mm-hmm. Did you have ambitions to become what were your ambitions at the time?
I think Yeah, at that time, I think my ambitions was to become a really good news photographer. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to be where the big news headlines of Norway and the world. I wanted to be there and photograph when they would happen. For me, that was kind of a possibility to explore and see the big things in our society, the things that really intrigue me, and convey that image to my friends and family and viewers.
Well, it's a very interesting background, and not something that I guess the vast majority of kids when you were starting. I would call you a kid. You're not now, but they would do. So it's an interesting hobby. So there's a lot of good lessons there.
but I think like. Of course, now I don't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. But I still, when I'm out, maybe I'm cycling home from my office. If I see a police car or a fire truck rushing up the street, I usually get on my bike and cycle after them and try to see where they're heading. So it's still in me somewhere.
Was there anything that you ended up covering that stuck with you, that particularly moved you, or that you recall?
I think when I started doing this, I was really I didn't have the training, I didn't have the skills maybe needed, mm-hmm. and I wasn't maybe that good at knowing the risks involved. Mm-hmm. So I had like one incident where it came over the police scanner. I was probably 16, 17 years old, that there were armed robbery of a bank. Mm-hmm. And that was like 200, 300 meters from the apartment I was living in. So I jumped on my bike and I got down there like in a matter of minutes, and I didn't see any police there. I didn't see anything, but like suddenly I saw maybe like 10, 15 heavily armed policemen coming from around the corner, going to storm the bank and see if there were any armed robbers there. So I of course wanted to get as close as possible. So I ran out in the street, right in front of the bank, photographing when they were storming, basically. And as I was going to take a photo, I felt like two really strong grips around my body. Then there were civilian police officers that grabbed me and pulled me back, because I was, of course, endangering myself and the other personnel involved. So then I realized that maybe it could be a good idea to think before you do something drastically.
Yeah, probably. I suppose at that age there's a different mindset, but there's probably and perhaps, I don't know, maybe war correspondents still have this, but an instinct to go towards the danger.
Yeah, and I think like in one way I still do. So mm-hmm. I've covered the war in Eastern Ukraine quite mm-hmm. extensively the last mm-hmm. few years, and I think in some ways that was also what got me interested in doing this project as well, with the internet wars. It is like in many ways it's quite similar. You have a war going on. You have really strong fronts, but of course, it's happening on a digital era.
Mm-hmm. The conversation this guy Zach Novak that you covered in the Internet Warriors. He's a very intriguing character, and we'll get into him and the others in a moment. But there is something there, and maybe we can transition to the Internet Warriors a little bit here. There's probably something around meaning that ties all of these individuals together who comment on things, I'm curious what you well, first of all, maybe we can just back up for a moment and just start to think about or if you could explain where this idea came from to cover people who are effectively or often called trolls on the internet.
So I started with this project back in 2013, and I think it was around Christmas times. I was spending time with my family, and I think like in a break or something between dinner, I logged onto my computer and I read an article about immigration, about the refugee crisis that has just had exploded. And I scrolled down on this article and I saw so many really hateful comments. Mm. I saw comments that were dehumanizing the people, that were really harsh. And I was quite intrigued because in my circle of friends and family, I didn't have any people that I knew of that had these types of opinions. Mm-hmm. So I was really like intrigued in who are these people, basically. So in this comment section, I could click on the Facebook profiles of the people. So I would click on the profiles and I could see that many of them that were commenting these really horrible comments, they were they seemed quite normal. They could have a steady job, they seemed to have a family, they would pose with their friends or children in their profile picture. Mm-hmm. In many ways they seemed like really normal and nice in many ways, and for me that became such a huge contrast between these really horrible horrible comments and these seemingly normal people. And that, like, then I knew that, okay, this is something to dig into. So I decided almost that day that it would be a really, really interesting project to try to figure out who these people are. Mm-hmm. and visit them in their homes, basically.
How did you find, or how did you pick the people that you would, first of all, how did you create this sort of list of people that you wanted to somehow profile, and how did you get in touch with them? And you know, what were some of those dynamics?
So I during these years of this project, I've become quite skillful at stalking people on Facebook. So I think like I have a list of between 500 and 1,000 people that I've noted down that are really active. Mm-hmm. I noted down how to contact them, some information. A lot of them I've tried to come in contact with to try to mm-hmm. figure out if they would be interesting characters to have in the project.
Break that down for us, because
yeah.
You know, if you get somebody who, you know, there are loads of people, but you know, there was a number of people that stood out for me, but there was the guy in the UK who identified with his white race. And so you do you reach out to somebody like that and, you know, hey, I noticed you're a troll and I'm doing a documentary about trolls. How would you like to be featured? You know, how does somebody get how do you engage with somebody like that in a way that they'll talk to you? And I imagine you have to form a bit of trust with those people. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, definitely. So, of course, a lot of the work in the project was actually doing exactly like that, trying to get the people to participate, but also finding the right characters. Mm-hmm. So what I used to do, I could use Facebook, I could use Twitter a lot, and a lot of different like online platforms, and I could spend hours and hours, days on trying to find the right character for each subject. So for instance, I was trying to find someone who was slut-shaming Kim Kardashian. Mm-hmm. So basically a person that were writing bad comments about Kim Kardashian. Mm-hmm. So trying to find that, I spent three full working days at my office going through all of the comments from that people had written on her account, Kim Kardashian's account on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So I would use different scripts mm-hmm. In order to find people that were calling her slut, for instance. So I could like search through all of the comments on that page, for instance. But it is a really tedious and
I can imagine
and so frustrating process, because like you could spend days to try to find a right person, and then, for instance, it could be impossible to find any contact information to that same individual. And if you would find the contact information and it was correct, then you had to try to convince them to participate, which is a whole different story. Yeah. And of course, many of the people that I met were really skeptical towards mainstream media, towards journalists, and also like towards this strange Norwegian 26-year-old guy who were trying to get a hold of them. But all of the people that I met, I tried to be really straightforward about my intentions, about why I was doing it. So I could say to them like, "Hi, this is Shira. I'm doing this documentary about internet commenters. I'm really interested in showing the diverse comment section about immigration, for instance." And I could be really honest that I wanted to show people who were both right-wing extremists, people who were leftist extremists, that I wanted to show like all aspects of the political debate. And a lot of people thought that I was sincere, and of course a lot of people refused the offer.
Sure. Yeah, I can imagine you. Well, how many people did you reach out to that said yes versus was it 1 in 10, 1 in 5 roughly?
I think 20-30% of the people I reached out to and that I like had a dialogue with, they wanted to participate.
Okay.
But of course, like a lot of people, especially when I was reaching out to them on Twitter or Facebook, they just ignored me.
Sure.
Which I also can,
Sure. Yeah. It's social media after all.
But, yeah. Yeah.
What do you think caused the ones who said yes to do so? What was it? They trust you as an individual, do you think? Was it, so there's something about their personality?
I think like in many ways, these are people that have for many years, for a lot of them, they had seeked the attention of other people with their comments. So they have a desire in one way to get heard, to get their voice out. A lot of them could be quite frustrated about something, whether it be immigration or climate change or whatever. They had a reason for doing the commenting, and I think that was also something I was trying to get them to understand, that this would be a great way of them to showcase their comments, their opinion, and this is a great way to reach out to quite a large audience. And I think like the project now, it has been seen by millions, and some of the people that I met, they could have like 1,000 followers on Twitter.
Right.
So
it magnifies their potential impact, which is pretty interesting. And there are a number of characters there.
I could read one of them.
Yes, that'd be great.
So one who still is quite intriguing for me is one called Ashley Jones. She's living in Cardiff. She is a student. She's a student in psychology. So while I was searching for slut shamers, sorry for the word, but that's
what this it's is called. We can say whatever we want. So
that's good. Yes. Because her comment is a bit worse. So she wrote on Twitter to This was a Twitter comment directly to Lady Gaga, the artist. So she wrote, "That bitch has really fucking pissed me off. Fuck you, you tired ass showgirl cunt. Go back to the party city where you belong." and that I think is quite a harsh comment to write to someone that you don't know.
Did you get some understanding of where that came from?
Both yes and no. Mm-hmm. I think for her, it was just like she didn't care. She thought that writing these comments were just her form for entertainment. And in many ways, she's the closest to like the definition of an internet troll. People that go out and set opinions out to the world just in order to invoke anger, and they're just like screwing with the debate as a form. So usually she wouldn't have any thoughtful political debates. She would usually like go in and say something bad to another person just in order to do it, basically.
Do you think the motivation there is, or people like that, is to get a reaction and then to say, I created this stir, or this person reacted to what I said, or a bunch of people reacted to what I said, and isn't that cool? Do you think there's something like that going on?
Yeah, I would definitely think that, Ben. That they're trying to get a response. Mm-hmm. They're trying to get heard. Maybe so she can go and tell her friends the day after that she got a reply from Lady Gaga. Like, I don't know, but I think many of them get a kick out of it. And I think that for me to explore that emotion that she gets from writing these types of comments, that I think is quite interesting, because a lot of the reason that I started doing this project as well was because a lot of the debate about internet debating, it was done by people who were doing research on it. It was done by journalists, politicians. You didn't have that many voices from the people who were actually doing the commenting. And I think that is also something that we as a journalist need to think about, that it's also really important to get the voices of the people who are actually doing these types of things as well.
That's super fascinating, because we often hear about internet trolls, and there's all kinds of speculation in who are these people. And I suppose for somebody like the person we just talked to, Ashley, this wasn't available 10 years ago. You couldn't do this sort of thing and have some type of get some type of pleasure out of doing this sort of thing. I've always wondered myself about the fact that in some platforms, the comments are anonymous or somewhat anonymized. Twitter is a place like that. You can create a anonymous account and say anything you want, really. And I always thought that the fact that there's that anonymity, you're not standing in front of the person saying these things, which I think it would be very different if you were. But I think that lends itself. But honestly, don't know, because we don't know very much about these people. So this is such an interesting project, because you do go behind it. Was there something you were expecting that you didn't, or something that happened that you didn't quite expect when you were talking to these people?
I think what in many ways surprised me a bit was exactly like that expectation you have of these people, that they are maybe as horrible in person as they could seem online. But for many of them, I was greeted with tea and cookies, and I was greeted with a great amount of hospitality, and I think that was a bit surprising, and it also made it a bit more challenging in a way, because then it's of course a lot easier to get empathy with them, to understand where they're coming from. Mm-hmm. And I think that could surprise me. But also I think the fact that a lot of them were confirming stereotypes that I could think about internet commenters, such as that a lot of them are male, a lot of them are maybe older, they don't live in big cities, things like that are also confirmed by okay. research.
Okay.
They were also like, that did confirm in a way what I found.
Yeah, maybe we can talk a little bit about that. So you said that many of them didn't live in big cities, and I know, I followed some of the ones in the US and some of the ones in the UK. They certainly seemed like they lived in smaller towns or more remote locations. I found the one guy that I forget his name now, but it was actually the Norwegian guy. I think it's Kjell. I'm not sure how you pronounce the name, but
Kjell Frode.
Yes.
It's impossible to pronounce.
Yeah, I'm so sorry about that. But he had this sort of anti-Islamic, anti-immigrant stance, and then he talks about how he changed his mind. And it seems to me like a lot of the people that you spoke to, they perhaps would, I don't know, but maybe I'm interested in your thoughts, but if they were presented with, an immigrant family that lived next door or a coworker or something, do you think that they would perhaps soften their stance or slightly, change their view of things? Do you get that sense?
Yeah, I think for a lot of them, it's down to fear for the unknown. That they could have a fear for something new, that they could feel like they're left behind in society. And I think that for Kjell Frode as well, he was, as you say, he was had these quite harsh anti-immigration comments a few years back. And when I met him a few years later than he had written those comments, he was suddenly quite a lot more positive to immigration. So he said that after a refugee center had come to a small town village, then suddenly they weren't that scary anymore. And I think that can relate to a lot of the people that I met, that they had these like types of fears for something that they that maybe wasn't that rational. In a way, but like this is a really difficult subject, and a lot of the people I met as well, they were struggling to discuss it, because for a lot of them it's really black and white. It's either you're pro immigration or you're against immigration.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I can certainly see that. Did you get a sense of that there was a bit of loneliness as well amongst some of these people, that there was a sense of perhaps commenting gave them a sense of being connected to things? Or
yeah, I think so in many ways, that they a lot of them were single, a lot of them maybe didn't have that many friends or family, and for a lot of them they like communicating online was quite a big part of their everyday life. And especially a lot of the people I met in Norway was that as well, because they were on social benefits. So they weren't working, they didn't have any or that many friends, and I think that was like a downward spiral that almost when you first start commenting on these types of things, your opinion grows stronger in a way. And I think that is also a bit interesting with the research, because research show that people who have a strong opinion, if they meet people in the comment section that have a different opinion, they usually become they believe their opinion a lot more. So like their opinion or their belief is getting stronger if they're seeing criticism towards it.
Yes, I've seen that as well. I've come across that research as well. There's something about human beings, we want to be consistent as well. So it's very difficult to change our minds once we've invested in something, because we want to appear to be consistent to, you know, all the people that we interact with.
So it's it does take quite a lot for a human being to admit that one has done something wrong, for instance.
Yes, it does. One of the things that I also wanted to maybe pick up with you is there, for some of them, this guy Scott, I think, was an American conspiracy.
Yeah.
Believe, you know, you said conspiracy theory, and he said, no, conspiracy fact. And he said, I'm here to save the Earth, which was, you know, an interesting comment. And some of them, there was another, the Norwegian, I think her name is, again, I'm going to
Merete, maybe.
No, Sheena. Sheena. And, you know, very certain in her views. And I just wonder if some of the causes that these people comment on give them a sense of purpose. And, you know, a sense of purpose is also, you know, something that gives us value in our lives. And so in some ways it can be, you could consider that they see value in what they're doing.
I think so. And I think what really got me interested was that in many of these people, they have like this quite interesting disconnect in their beliefs and what they're maybe doing in person.
And you capture that very well, by the way.
Yeah, and I think, for instance, like Sina that you talked about, she had written a comment. This was on her Facebook. She wrote, "If Hitler had taken care of the Muslims instead of the Jews, the world had been better today, I think. Well, I can dream about it." So she was writing these comments on Facebook, which is quite harsh. But at the same time, she was like really in love with her immigrant husband. So on one hand, she was really skeptical towards immigrants, but on the other hand, she really loved her immigrant husband. And I think like that almost like disconnect in somebody's life is something that is, I think, quite astonishing to bear witness to. And I think maybe the people that I interviewed, when they see the final result afterwards, they realize that.
What also
there is something to think about. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah, there was also the English guy with the Thai wife, I think.
Yeah,
that one struck me as well.
There's many characters too.
What also struck
to be interesting.
What also struck me is, for so many of them, they had pets, right? And they took care of their pets, you know, rather lovingly as well, and or plants in their homes or whatever. And you think, well, this is, you know, this can't be a horrible person. There's a human being here, but somehow they're saying these horrific things, which the duality of it is fascinating.
Yeah, definitely. And I think what also fascinated me was, so I met with around 25 people in total, from all the way from Norway to the UK, to the US, to Russia and Lebanon. So I tried to have quite a broad selection of people. But also what I saw, that a lot of the people that I met, they had so many similarities. So both that with, they could be writing quite harsh comments and hateful comments and things that in many countries are illegal to say, basically racist comments. But at the same time, they could be really loving towards their family. One of the people I really remember quite vividly is Nick, who is living in Pennsylvania in the US. And I met with him just before the presidential election. So he was a really hardcore Trump supporter. He had written thousands of comments on Twitter. Like one of the comments he had written was, voting for Hillary is the same as killing your own children. Get ready for civil war if that cunt gets in. Hillary supporters will be first to go. So he's basically talking about a civil war.
Yep.
and he was also quite a he talked quite strongly about guns, of course. So he was quite a scary guy in my sense. Like if I don't think I would have a friend with those types of opinions in Norway, or at least I would be a bit scared of him, I think. Because I'm not that pro violence. But at the same time, he was writing these comments, I remember that his Twitter bio said like, I have 5 great kids and I'm in love with my wife. So at one point he was like calling Hillary a cunt and he's getting ready for civil war, but at the same time he was loving his kids. And he was also really skeptical, of course, towards me.
Right.
But I was able to go and meet him and spend a few days with him while Trump was getting elected as a president. So that was quite an interesting experience.
I can imagine. How did that interaction go? You said he was skeptical at first. How did he warm to you? What was it that was it just spending a bit of time with you? And
I wrote to him that I really wanted to follow him on Twitter because that's the only way to have personal communication with him. So I sent him a message like, hi, could you follow me? I'm doing a project about internet debating, something on those lines. And he just wrote back to me, no, you worked for the New York Times. So I had done a few jobs for New York Times, he figured out, and he let me down. But I continued to to try to reach out to him. And finally I got him to follow me. So I was able to write him a long message about what I was planning. And after a lot of back and forth, I was finally able to convince him and finally able to travel to Pennsylvania and spend a few days with him. And what is quite interesting now is that he's really happy with the result. He wrote me a message just a few weeks ago that, yeah, I'm so happy you were able to meet my family and, yeah, take care, man. So it is quite interesting to see how, you know, some people can change from on one hand being really skeptical and to the other hand being a bit lovely.
One of the things that I think may have contributed to that, just watching that piece and watching your work, is that you didn't really, you didn't put any layer of judgment or very minimal layer of judgment. You just kind of presented what you saw and you shared what they wrote. And that was it.
Yeah.
I mean, but obviously very, very well crafted, but I'm curious in terms of how you, what you went for when you were presenting each of these individual stories, because what it came out to me was obviously I read a lot into what people said and so forth, but just in terms of what's actually presented, it's fairly, I would say fairly non-judgmental, at least not very explicitly judgmental at all, which is very well done.
I think like when in the beginning of the project, I made a really conscious decision of not being really confrontive in the interviews. So I really wanted to listen. I really wanted to understand. I wanted to get them to explain why they were having those types of opinions. And I also knew that, or I, at least I have had a thought that if I was going to go in there and confronting the people, then they would probably just like shut down. They would go into like become really defensive, and I didn't think that would be any meaningful, a meaningful conversation or a documentary. But of course, that is tricky as well, because when you're not having a lot of critical questions towards their opinions, or stating that okay, that's a false fact, for instance, what you're claiming there. I didn't do any of that because for me that was, I just wanted the whole project to be really transparent, to be really open, and have the audience judge and have the audience make up their own opinions about these people, so that it wouldn't be me. But of course that is tricky as well, because you could say that then I'm creating a platform for them to express their hatred, for instance, which is in many ways can be a fair point. But for me, I think it's a lot more important to know the full extent of someone's opinion and the unfiltered message that they are coming with. I think that is the only way that we can deal with opinions and political views in a way that is constructive in today's society.
I think that you absolutely succeeded in that regard, because it's so easy to be dismissive of comments, and you watch these people, and regardless of you know who they are, you do notice their pets, you do notice their family, you do notice their homes, you know, the food that they have, and regardless of where they're coming from politically, it's almost impossible not to feel some type of a connection with them, even if you can completely disagree with some of the views that are presented.
Yeah, definitely, and of course I didn't agree with all of the things that the people were stating, but I really wanted to keep my personal opinions out of the project. Just let them talk out. Yeah.
Absolutely. How easy or difficult was that for you?
It could be. Sometimes it was really difficult. It's really difficult to hear political discussions about a really sensitive subject, and hear people expressing views that, in my beliefs, are horrible. It could be like one thing is to have a political debate where you don't agree with someone. That's totally fine. I totally respect that. But when people are wanting to kill each other, when people are saying that they would want to have Auschwitz back, but for Muslims, for instance, those types of opinions are so horrible that it's difficult to, to know how to react to. So in many of the interviews, I would just sit down and shut up, basically, and just let it go in one ear and out the other. But when I also remember, like, I could spend weeks on weeks on end on going through comment sections on I think like English Defense League and Facebook pages like that. And a lot of the comments were just so horrible, and people would talk about other people in ways that for me is quite horrible, and that that was in times difficult, definitely. But I think also knowing that, where I always felt like this project was important, so I think in many ways that helped me get through it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really glad that I don't go to the comment sections anymore.
On the odd occasion I would scroll through, not even, you know, English Defense League or whatever, just to comment on a mainstream article in Facebook, and just you spend 15 minutes there and get depressed. So you spending a whole day, you know, looking at this for
3 years.
I can imagine might either take its toll or also maybe numb you a little bit to this, but you know, very very well done for getting through that and actually you know getting at some of the humanity of some of these people. Could we maybe talk about one or two these individuals that I found very intriguing? One was this guy Zach Novak, who's this pro Russian rebel. Is he American?
He is American.
Yeah, really interesting story. How this guy would, you know, find himself in the Ukraine fighting with pro-Russian rebels, he's American. What is his story? What is his background?
So, if I remember correctly, so he was, he had some family in Poland, and he was fighting. I can read a bit out from him. So,
sure.
American Zach Novak claims to be considered a terrorist by his homeland, and says he will face time in jail if he returns. But as a pro-Russian separatist living in eastern Ukraine, he thinks that's kind of cool. So he have been living in a lot of different countries. But he started to, or he traveled to eastern Ukraine because he thought like this was his mission. This was important for him. He wanted to protect the Russian, basically. Because if I remember correctly, he came into an argument with the U.S. authorities. And that was one of the main reasons that he fled. Mm-hmm. And I think he is definitely a character in many ways, because having quite a smart guy traveling from a place where that many see as free as the U.S. and traveling to fight with Russian separatists, I think that is quite that's a long travel.
Yes, yes, it is. I think he said he grew up or lived in New York City, and you wonder how what the journey was, what the thought process was, what he thinks he's doing. But again, I think there's something about a sense of belonging and purpose, I think, that that makes people like that feel alive.
Okay, I can quote him a bit more. So he said that I don't really miss the Big Apple anymore. I moved here to eastern Ukraine to join my brothers in the fight against the Ukrainian fascists, NATO and the US. As a pro-Russian separatist, I'm here to tell the truth. So he was also he was working with like propaganda for the separatists, basically. Mm-hmm. So I can quote him again. I don't carry a machine gun anymore. Now I'm an information warrior with a keyboard. My front line is the internet. As an American, it's important for me to tell the world about the situation here. Information is more deadly than any NATO bomb. So that's, his point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that one is very intriguing to me. So you've been covering Ukraine, so I imagine there's some overlap in terms of your other work that allowed you to gain access to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I've been working there as I said in the beginning quite extensively. But now actually I'm kicked out of the of the Donetsk. I think maybe they didn't like some of my critical reporting from there. But I'm still seeing Nick on Facebook and seeing what he's up to, and he's still doing the same thing as he was doing a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The other one that intrigued me was this anti-American, I think he was a Syrian refugee, if I'm not mistaken. Imad Osman.
Who you
met in Lebanon.
Yeah.
I thought he was very interesting.
I worked quite hard to try to find people with different background and different opinions, and at least for Imad, he wasn't that like critical towards the US actually, but he became quite a harsh contrast to a lot of the other people, and I think that was the reason I really wanted to have him with me. So one of the comments that he had written, this one was on Facebook. So he wrote, "The one who waits for democracy from America is the same who expects the devil will bring them back to heaven." And I think even though that is, a lot of people would definitely disagree on it. But in many ways as well, you could say that he has a point.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So at least I think what was important for me was to get a lot of different opinions from people actually, that were discussing a political thing that was really important for them. And for Imad, that was from Syria. For him, it was really important to discuss this topic. He had fled the bombing from Assad, and he was really angry at the U.S. for not helping them out.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yes.
Yeah.
Some of his sentiments probably would be echoed by people that he would find diametrically opposed to his political opinion.
yeah, definitely. And I think what is quite interesting with this subject as well is that a lot of the people, they would only see news and opinions that they agreed on. Because how Facebook is built up and Twitter.
That's right.
Yeah. They only get news stories that they are interested in, and in many ways, then the discussion and the debates and the opinions become a lot more polarized. And I think for Imad, that's definitely true, and for a lot of the others as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, Imad even said, I'm on Facebook sort of 24 hours a day or something like this, and I'm checking the news, which is, Facebook, what's going on in Syria. And so, he gets his information from Facebook, as I would imagine most of the other people that you spoke to spend an inordinate amount of time on Facebook and other platforms.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that is quite scary about this as well. It is difficult to adjust your opinion if it's only getting confirmed in a way. I think, and that is I think really, really important in today's society is that we try to find a solution on that. That is important to be able to listen to also people that have a different opinion than you have. It's really important for me to listen to opinions that are not the same as my political views, so that one try to understand and respect the other person to some degree at least.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's harder and harder to do. The thing I wanted to maybe explore a bit was some of your thoughts, having done this project, around how we can start to break some of those barriers down.
I think that is tricky as well. I think it's tricky to do online, at least. I think it's difficult to do in a comment section to get other people to change their opinions.
Fully agree, yeah.
But I do believe that it is important to try to have a good and fruitful debate, for instance, in the comment section, that I think it's important to let everybody be able to discuss, but I think it's also important that we try to get people to behave. Maybe we would need to be stricter with what types of comments we are having published or getting published. But I think it's really important that we try to, in our physical life, that we try to talk to people that have an opinion that differs from the one have. And I've gotten so many responses after this was published from people who were writing me emails saying that now I'm going to go over to my neighbor who has this really strong opinion about something. I'm going to go and talk with him and try to like almost change his mind. And I think at least that is a way to go, to discuss and create that atmosphere for debate. That I think is really important, and I don't think that will happen that much online. And I think also like big companies as Facebook has a really key role in this as well, that we can't have algorithms that only lift articles and opinions that are similar to the ones you have. You need to have like opinions from the whole political scale.
So you think there's something that Facebook can be doing? I don't know if you saw the piece in Wired magazine last week about Facebook and its
yes. That was highly interesting, definitely. And I think that article showed that how difficult this is as well. Like, it is such a difficult topic. It's such a difficult debate. But I do believe that it is important that we are we're opening up the political landscape, not closing it in on only the people we want to listen to. And there, I think Facebook has quite a large responsibility.
I know that we're going to need to wrap it up soon, but I was interested in, we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, but your own approaches to risk and uncertainty in documentary making, because I imagine when you go into a project, you don't really know what you're going to get. So I imagine you have a high tolerance for uncertainty in the work that you do, and you seem to be somebody that that works on the edges, right? But I'm curious to explore that and how you think your approach to uncertainty affects your ability to make good documentaries.
I think like I've never had a steady job. So I've always been a freelancer. I've always been traveling around a lot, and for me, I think having that quite free life, that was also really important for me to be able to do this type of documentary, because of course I had to sacrifice a lot. I had to sacrifice a lot of like time and money and a lot of uncertainty, of course, if this project would like be doable and how much it would cost, if it would like ruin me, or you know, like there were so many risks involved. But of course, I do like to work on things when the stakes are high. Mm-hmm. I don't like to go into a project or doing a story and like doing it halfway. Then I'm more trying to like put all of my odds in and hope for the best. And that has worked out up until now, at least. So let's hope that it will continue.
Absolutely. Well, if the Internet Warriors is any indication, then I think you've got a very, very bright future. So,
thanks, man.
Speaking of which, what are some of your future projects? Where do you go next?
I'm working on this big project about climate change, mm-hmm. Which is also like a really difficult topic. Mm. In order to get like people to actually care or click on a project about climate change, so I'm really like turning my head around to try to figure out how to tell that story and those stories in a compelling way. So that is one thing I'm working on, and I'm also traveling up to the most violent city in Norway in a couple of couple of weeks. It isn't like Detroit, but it is violent in Norwegian standards.
Sure. Yeah. Well, sorry, what city is that? What's the name of the city?
It's called Hasvik, okay, in Finnmark. So it's way up north. Mm-hmm. It's going to be like minus 20 degrees. Mm-hmm. And a lot of snow. So I think that would be
that'd be interesting. What makes it so violent? What is it?
Well, it's difficult to say, but it's an isolated island. It has almost no police. And it's a society where you have to take care of your own business. Like you have to take care of it by yourself. Mm. And there's also a lot of alcohol. There's a high unemployment rate. So there's all of these, like it's a cocktail of different things that I think has made it like top the statistics for the last 5 or 10 years.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, it does.
Very cool. And any other things that you've thought about if you had an infinite amount of money to explore a topic, are there some things that intrigue you?
I think like if I had like a lot of money, it would be really interesting to just continue doing these types of stories that I really care about, like how people are affected by, you know, big social changes, and not do so many like corporate headshots and stuff. I also have to do to get the money flowing in.
Right, so, right. Is that how you keep money coming in? You do those kinds of things.
Yeah, I do those types of things, and weddings. Big part of my economy.
Very, very cool. Well, this was great. I really, you know, I've enjoyed this. And before we go, was there anything that we didn't get to cover that you wanted to mention?
No, but I think like having people check out the project, that would be more than enough. It's available.
Go for it. Where can people find you and the Internet Warriors?
So they could go to theinternetwarriors.com, and then you can see all of the videos basically of these characters. There's also a book that is possible to have a look at. With all of the interviews, so I would be I would recommend it, but I know that I'm not that objective.
No, it's great. I definitely do recommend it. It's a wonderful documentary and wonderful set of videos, and it does bring, as we've talked about, it brings out the humanity of some of these people, which I think in some way is what's required. I don't think anyone has the answers, but I think there's something there that you're onto, that you've unlocked and uncovered, that few have elsewhere. Because it's easy to sort of say, and I don't know if you remember the American election, but when Hillary Clinton called the Trump supporters the deplorables, that was probably that was just a terrible thing to say. It's alienating. It doesn't connect. Yeah. It does the opposite of connect. We can look at people's comments and say, well, call people names and vice versa, but it doesn't do anything, does it? It doesn't move the bar. It doesn't create any type of common ground. And I think what you've done in a very skillful way is to start to do that. So
I remember a quote that I wrote down like in the midst of all of this research, that was two liberals sitting together talking about how bad racism is doesn't do any good.
That's right.
Which I think is a fair ending note.
Shira, this was great. I really enjoy this, and I commend you on the work that you've done. And I hope that you continue to do this. And I wanted to thank you very much for coming on to the All Things Risk podcast.
Thank you so much, Ben.
I hope you guys found that interesting and useful. Links to the Internet Warriors film and book are in the show notes, of course. As I was editing this episode, I did pause and think about whether or not Shida, and now I, by putting out the episode, was somehow giving these internet warriors a platform. And then I reflected that, if we are to combat this problem of echo chambers and fake news, we need to understand this phenomenon. These people aren't going away. And I was also reminded of Gleb Sapirsky. Gleb was our guest in our previous episode. His concept of EGRIP, how to engage with people we don't agree with. And that E stands for empathy. And this, of course, is a podcast about understanding our world and its risks. So it did make a lot of sense to share Shida's project with all of you. But I'd like to know what you guys think. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to send me some feedback. You can go to allthingsrisk.co.uk, that's .co.uk, which is our website, to subscribe to the show if you haven't yet done so. As always, leave a rating and review on iTunes. That helps us out a lot. Would love to hear from you guys. We will be back with our next episode next week. In the interim, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.